Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In his new collection of writings, Lessons from a Dark Time, today's guest, journalist and writer Adam Hochschild, reflects on times when dangerous rhetoric and politics encroached on crucial rights and freedoms abroad and at home. The echoes of these times can be heard today in rising social tensions, hysteria in the public discourse, and the erosion of privacy, freedom of speech, and other essential protections. Hochschild warns that we cannot comfort ourselves by saying that in the past dark times, people did not know what was going on. The transgressions of elected officials were in full public view. Knowing the facts, he writes, is not enough. The public, the press, and the courts also have to believe that no one is above the law. He also says that when times are dark, we need moral ancestors, and offers his writings as a reminder that so many people have fought and won battles against injustices like those we face today, including racism and xenophobia. So how have past injustices been corrected, and how did the communities he writes about survive and thrive during dark times? Adam Hochschild is a longtime journalist and author who has written on issues of social justice and human rights. He is the author of several books, including King Leopold's Ghost. He's one of the co-founders of Mother Jones Magazine, and his latest book is a collection of really incredible essays called Lessons from a Dark Time and Other Essays. Hi, Adam. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. It's good to be with you. I hear your voice and I listen to KLW all the time.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I'm so sorry I can't be in studio to meet you in person, but thank you for writing really this amazing book. We'll get into it in just a minute, but I want to ask you a fairly general question about journalism today. Time Magazine's Person of the Year are four journalists and a newspaper, and the journalists were either imprisoned or murdered this year. And I'm so glad that they named journalists the person of the year rather than one individual. And I just want to learn a little bit more about you. Since we have time, you have been a journalist for a long time. You've written about so many important events in history. In 1967, you were a staff writer at Ramparts, which I know a lot of our listeners are familiar with. But give us a sense of just why you decided to become a journalist and what you think the role of journalism is today.
Well, I was very glad to see that, by the way, about Time Magazine also, because I think we forget, living in the United States, that practicing journalism in many parts of the world is really a very dangerous business. People in Mexico, the Philippines, Russia, various countries in Eastern Europe, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, you know, they end up dead or behind bars or horribly tortured for doing the kind of thing that we here in America are usually quite safe in doing. And I'm glad to see some of these brave folks honored. I got into this profession more than 50 years ago, and I'm very glad that I did. Why did I do it? I think because, I don't know, in some ways, most journalists, I think, want to have an excuse to poke into other people's lives. And I feel that as a journalist, you can do that better than anybody except perhaps for a psychiatrist. You have an excuse when you go out with your voice recorder or your notebook. You have an excuse for asking people questions. You step outside your role as a person, and in your role representing a newspaper, a magazine, a radio station, or whatever, you have the right to ask people their opinions, their feelings. And you know what? Most people in the world really are so eager to tell their stories. You very rarely get a door slammed in your face. Maybe, you know, if you try to write about the mafia or the CIA or something, that can happen. But most people want to tell their stories. And as a journalist, I love to hear them. I started off as a daily newspaper reporter more than 50 years ago, spent most of that time at the San Francisco Chronicle. And that was back in the days of manual typewriters, and when you finished your story, a pneumatic tube whisked it out to the printers in another part of the building, and you heard the sort of whoosh of your story traveling down that pneumatic tube, and then there was the excitement a few hours later when you saw it in the printed newspaper. So it's quite a far cry from today, when everything is, you know, on computers, but there's still a basic excitement in going out and hearing other people's stories, trying to make sense of them, trying to figure out what's the best way I can portray that story for the reader.
Your book, Adam, was published by UC Press, and I love this line in the press release: with the skills of a journalist, the knowledge of a historian, and the heart of an activist, Hochschild shares the stories of people who took a stand against despotism. I have to say, I really love that they included the heart of an activist, because I find that, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, when young people come and visit the studio, for some reason, the first question they always ask is, do you consider yourself an activist? And what do you think of activist journalism? And I always wonder, where is this question coming from? And I really think it's this sort of focus on fair and balanced news. But I just wonder what you think about that.
Well, I think there is a long and honorable tradition of journalists crusading for justice in one way or another. I think any journalist, whether you think of yourself as a crusader or think of somebody as just reporting the news in a neutral and straightforward fashion, you have to adhere to very high standards of accuracy. And that's a sine qua non that everybody has to follow. And, of course, not everyone does follow it. But beyond that, I see the activism as what stories you decide to cover. Are you going to write about manifest injustices in the society? Are you going to write about how people are suffering under repressive regimes? Are you going to look at what the American connection to those regimes are? These are the kinds of stories I've tended to follow. And I don't mean to say that I'm blind to all sorts of other kinds of injustices as well. I did a whole book about how Russians were coming to terms with the Stalin era and the sort of self-inflicted genocide that that country did to itself during those times. And in fact, the photograph on the cover of this new book, Lessons from a Dark Time, is from a trip in the Soviet Union. It's a picture looking out through the cell bars of the internal prison within a much larger gulag camp that I visited in far northeast Siberia when I was working on that book about Russia. So I like to think of myself as the kind of journalist, the kind of writer who shines a light on injustices in many different places, and especially on the people who tried to expose them and resist them, because that, to me, is what's really most fun to write about. I've been lucky to find some of those people in the present day. One of the pieces in this book is about a day on the campaign trail in 1994 with Nelson Mandela. And I've tried to find some of those people historically, whether those who tried to put the atrocities in King Leopold's Congo on the world's front pages more than 100 years ago, or people doing the same kind of thing about the injustices of slavery more than 200 years ago. But I get the same pleasure in writing about such people, whether they're a long time ago or in the world today.
And given that you do focus on injustice and the people who are resisting and fighting back, I mean, this is a big question, but when we do this show day after day after day, I often wonder, people like you who have really dedicated your life to writing about injustice and so many important pieces of history. You write about World War I, World War II. You write about rape in the Congo. Just there's so much in this book, and this is just one collection of your essays. When you sit back and you look at where we are today and how, you know, the media has changed so much, Donald Trump, the rise of right-wing fascist governments in Europe, I mean, obviously, it's hard for you to kind of say this in a minute. How do you explain where we are right now? But what, I mean, someone like yourself who's spent 50 years doing this, how do you think about where we are today? Like, what goes through your mind?
Well, let's look at the media landscape to begin with. And I think in many ways we're better off than we were 50 or 100 years ago. The title piece in this book, Lessons from a Dark Time, is about the dark time that the United States went through in the period 1917 to 1920, which was really, I think, the period of greatest repression in American history since the end of slavery. You know, lynchings of black people in the South were at an all-time high during this period. There was so much fury at labor organizers that some white people got lynched as well. There were more than 1,200 people who were imprisoned for opposing American entry into World War I. 3,000 people deported from the United States. 75 newspapers and magazines, because of their opposition to American participation in the First World War, either had entire issues censored or were shut down completely. That really was a dark time. We're better off today. We have an extremely thuggish, dangerous president, but we've got a media that, with the exception of Fox News, which I think really shouldn't be thought of as a news organization but sort of as a religious broadcaster of sorts, with the exception of places like that, the media is standing up to Trump pretty well. And I think the great newspapers like the New York Times and the Washington Post are doing an extraordinary job of investigative journalism. And, you know, this remains one of the countries where you can look at the major newspapers or you can turn on a major radio network like NPR and get some sense of what's happening in the world. And that's not true in huge parts of the world where dissident news of all kinds, critical news of all kinds, is censored. So as to where we are today, as far as the media goes, I think we're better off than we were 100 years ago. And the Internet has enormous dangers, and we've certainly seen some of them in all the controversy about Facebook recently, but it's also allowed dissident voices to flourish in a way that wasn't easily possible before. You know, previously, 50, 60 years ago, dissident voices were small left-wing magazines like The Nation, The Progressive. Today, something like Mother Jones, which I helped to found more than 40 years ago, you know, they get like 10 million page views a month on the Internet. That wasn't possible before. As to where we are politically, I agree. It is a bad time. But don't forget, most of us in this country did not vote for this guy 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I think the elections that we had last month were a very hopeful sign that most Americans really don't like him and what he stands for. And I'm optimistic that there'll be some changes in 2020.
Yeah, I always say when we do about voting, when you hear people in the media say half the country voted for Trump, it's like, no, that's not true. 100 million people did not vote. And it's such an important number to repeat and to remind yourself of.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And of course, there are nasty forces that want to keep those people not voting. And we know there are all kinds of voter suppression efforts going on, particularly in Republican-controlled states in the South and elsewhere. But don't forget, look at it historically. You know, 60 years ago, the voter suppression efforts were far more successful. They, in effect, prevented most black people in the South from voting. That's changed.
Today, we are speaking with longtime journalist and author Adam Hochschild, who has written on issues of human rights and social justice. His books include the best-selling King Leopold's Ghost, and his new collection of essays is Lessons from a Dark Time and Other Essays. And if you have any questions or comments for Adam, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. What were some dark times in history that you personally experienced, or maybe your family experienced? What lessons should we learn from those times? And again, what's so important about an hour show is that we can really dive in and talk about history. What parts of history do you believe that we're repeating? What are your thoughts about really overcoming this kind of injustice? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. As you said, Adam, your first section, your first essay, Lessons from a Dark Time, is about World War I. And you write a lot in this book about surveillance and repression in the United States between 1917 and 1920 in the name of anti-communism. And you write, quote, "The final lesson from this dark time is that when a president has no tolerance for opposition, the greatest godsend he can have is a war. Then dissent becomes not just, quote, fake news, but treason. We should be wary." I have to say, I loved this chapter. Can you talk about, I mean, there's so much in this chapter about how when Woodrow Wilson went before Congress on April 2nd, 1917, and asked it to declare war on Germany, the country was riven by divisions, as it is today. First off, let's just talk about that.
Well, it really is amazing to me the kind of chauvinist fury that spilled out once the United States entered the First World War. I think that this had been building for a while. There were a number of real points of tension in the country. One, of course, was between the great captains of industry of the industrial age, the robber barons, who really dominated the Gilded Age, as they called it, and the rise of labor unions, especially the most militant, the Wobblies, the Industrial Workers of the World, or IWW. And there were tremendous tensions. There were dozens of workers who were killed in strikes each year that were put down by the police, by the army, by the National Guard. There was a lot of tension around that. And as soon as the U.S. entered the First World War, the government used the war as an excuse to crack down really ruthlessly on the labor movement. For example, in Bisbee, Arizona, and there was a recent film about this, actually, which I haven't seen, but it just came out. In Bisbee, Arizona, there was a copper strike run by the Wobblies, and copper, because it was a principal ingredient of bullet casings and various other military hardware, the government used this as an excuse to crack down on this mining strike. The sheriff in town, with the aid of the mining company, Phelps Dodge and Company, got up a posse of 2,000 people armed. They rounded up more than 1,200 strikers and their supporters, kept them in an open field under the hot sun for a few hours, then put them into freight cars and transported them, with armed men on the roof guarding this train, 180 miles into the desert, across the state line into New Mexico, and dumped them in an army stockade there. And there were other instances of things like this happening around the United States as the government used the war as an excuse to crack down on labor, with heavy support, of course, from the big business. Another tension in the U.S. at that time, as we have today, was over immigration. At that point, the big tension was over the fact that starting around 1890, the new immigrants flooding into the United States from Europe, which had been going on for a long time, tended no longer to be from Northern and Western Europe, countries like Germany, Holland, Scandinavia, and so on, but overwhelmingly coming from the poor areas of Italy and Sicily, from Eastern Europe, and from Russia. And that meant people who were Roman Catholic, Eastern Orthodox, or Jewish. This was enormously upsetting to the Anglo-Saxon elite who had dominated this country really since colonial days. And it led to the rise of the eugenics movement, where people talked about how the great Anglo-Saxon gene pool was being polluted by all these Jews and Southern Italians and Sicilians and so on. And the war provided an excuse to crack down on immigrants as well. And I think it gave a big boost to the eugenics movement, all of which culminated in the extremely restrictive immigration laws that were finally passed in 1924, which essentially virtually closed off this immigration from Southern and Eastern Europe. So these were some of the tensions in the country at the time. And this was all happening under a president, Woodrow Wilson, whom we remember today for his internationalist idealism, you know, being a big proponent of the League of Nations. But he had no tolerance for dissent, and he used the war as an excuse for cracking down on dissenters in really quite a ruthless and brutal way.
So brutal. In your book, you write, once the U.S. entered the war, shortly after Wilson's second term began, the crushing swiftly reached a frenzy. The government started arresting and interning native-born Germans who were not naturalized U.S. citizens. Families named Schmidt quickly became Smith. German language textbooks were tossed on bonfires. And you have an amazing, horrific story about a German-born, he was a coal miner named Robert Prager. Can you tell us what happened to Robert Prager in Collinsville, Illinois?
Yeah, he was German-born, and that was his ill luck. A crowd surrounded him, wrapped him in the American flag, made him sing the Star-Spangled Banner, and lynched him from a tree on the edge of town. And it made no difference that he had actually tried to enlist in the U.S. Navy, but had been turned down because he had a glass eye. And 11 ringleaders of the mob that lynched him were put on trial, and they were found innocent by a jury while a military band played outside the courthouse. So that's the kind of atmosphere there was in the United States at that time. And I think for all our problems today, we have a much healthier measure of dissent nationally. And that's why I feel, you know, it's not quite so dark today, no matter, despite the fact that it sometimes looks that way.
Well, right. And that's why it's so important to read essays like yours. You also write that the New York Herald published the names and addresses of every German or Austro-Hungarian national living in the city. I mean, that's amazing, publishing the names. How did the public respond to all of this?
Yeah, I got that. Publishing the names is the equivalent of, what do they call it, doxing, when you put somebody's personal information on the internet today.
Right.
The public responded by basically going along with it. There were relatively few dissenters. There were, well, a few dissenters who could make themselves heard. There were some 3 million Americans who simply didn't show up to register for the draft. A much smaller number registered and then openly resisted, and some 500 were sent to prison for that. But there was a lot of dissent against the war. People thought, why should the United States be getting mixed up in this conflict in Europe that isn't really our quarrel? But the government did its best to cripple the expression of that dissent. They put people on trial for organizing against the draft, for example. The great anarchist leader, Emma Goldman, was one of those. She was sentenced to 2 years in prison for organizing against the draft. When she was put on trial, she was accused of being unpatriotic, and she made this wonderful speech to the jury where she said, gentlemen of the jury, because of course it was all gentlemen in those days, no ladies, my American patriotism is like that of a man who loves a woman with open eyes. He is enchanted by her beauty, but he is not blind to her faults. And I think that's still a great definition of patriotism today.
Hmm. Today we're speaking with Adam Hochschild, a journalist and author who has written on issues of human rights and social justice. He shines a very bright light on injustice and also shines a light on people who expose injustice and resist. His books include the best-selling King Leopold's Ghost, and his latest book is a collection of his essays, Lessons from a Dark Time and Other Essays. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our end of the year book show. We're going to be talking with independent bookstore owners about what they and their customers are reading. I hope you can call in with your book recommendations. And then on Thursday, we're doing a show about a new documentary called Drugs, The Price We Pay. And it's about why so many pharmaceutical drug prices are skyrocketing. And we'll talk about how it affects the people struggling to stay alive. Bernie Sanders has introduced yet another bill to try to tackle this issue. So I hope you can join us for that. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. Today we are speaking with Adam Hochschild, a longtime journalist and author who writes about human rights and social justice. He is out with a new book. It's a collection of his essays called Lessons from a Dark Time. Speaking of books to recommend, I hope you can get your hands on this book because the essays really are amazing, from the Congo to India. He writes about World War I, World War II, about history, and about books. You can give us a call if you have any questions or comments for Adam, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. And let's hear from Nancy in Berkeley. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I really, really admire Adam Hochschild. I read all his articles in the New Yorker and his books, and I've been to a couple of his book readings, and he's just terrific. Anyways, I think he and I are probably about the same age, and I lived through the McCarthy era. I'm from Chicago, and my parents weren't actually communists, but they were probably fellow travelers, as they say. And it was a very, very scary time. We had the FBI come to our house and rifle through our books. I remember whenever somebody knocked at our apartment door, my parents would take all the books that they thought they might be have problems with and put them under beds and hide them in the refrigerator and do whatever they could. And these FBI guys would come in and look through our books. And we had a number of friends of my parents who were interrogated and jailed, and it was a horrible, horrible time. And then, the Rosenbergs were executed for, as far as I'm concerned, no reason whatsoever. And it was scarier than now. Although I was young, so maybe I was scarier than I am now.
Wow, thank you for sharing that, Nancy. I was going to ask you, what are your thoughts about what we're talking about today, where we are today versus the past?
I'm 79, so I've lived through a lot of stuff, and I can't say I'm really scared. I'm just disgusted and angry, and I'm worried what will become I mean, I feel that Trump, you know, can in the next couple years can, you know, can really destroy us economically, and he's, you know, he's a real horrible threat. But I think that, you know, especially the last election gave me a lot of hope that, you know, maybe, although I keep thinking that, you know, when as we get closer to 220, he will figure out some way to declare martial law and, you know, not have an election. That's a little...
Well, yeah. If he's still in office then, or if maybe another Republican will take him out, who knows? Adam, what are your thoughts about this? Because you were the subject of FBI surveillance and managed to get redacted copies of more than 100 pages of files from the FBI, the CIA, and military intelligence. And you have a pretty wild story here about how this informant garbled this and filed notes about what you actually did.
I'll tell you the story, but I should say also, happily, I never had to endure anything like Nancy and her parents did, and it is shocking what the government did to so many people during that time. I remember the McCarthy era too, but mainly in terms of my parents sitting and fuming at the hearings as they were on TV. My own experience of being under surveillance came a little bit later. In the 1960s, I was active in a student peace group in college and then very active in the movement against the Vietnam War. And in those days, J. Edgar Hoover's FBI sometimes wanted you to know that they were watching you. The first time I became aware of this was as a college student. I was passing out leaflets about a demonstration we had organized against a demonstration in favor of an atmospheric nuclear test ban, not exactly a deeply subversive thing, and in fact it finally was agreed to by the United States and the Soviet Union in 1963, but this was a year or two before then. And I remember in a corner of the park where I was passing out these leaflets before a demonstration, my job was to look for members of the press, anybody who looked like a reporter. I would give him or her a copy of our press release and one of our leaflets. And here were these four guys standing very close together, glowering in trench coats and fedoras. And it was clear they wanted us to know that they were glowering at us and watching us. So I went up to them. I could tell who they were. And I said, are you gentlemen from the press? And one of them said, yeah, give me one of those. And he grabbed the press release and but didn't ask any questions the way he would have if he'd actually been a reporter. And then there were other indications that the anti-war groups that I was involved with were being spied on in one way or another. And then I worked at Ramparts magazine in the late 1960s, and Ramparts at one point published a very important expose showing how the CIA had infiltrated and essentially controlled for many years the National Student Association, which was the premier organization of American college students, and something much more important then than it is today. And this, in turn, very quickly led to the discovery of all sorts of other ostensibly private organizations which the CIA had funded and manipulated and controlled for many years. And then in the 1970s, it became possible to use the Freedom of Information Act, which was passed in a spirit of revulsion against all these things, the Freedom of Information Act, to get copies of the files kept on you by the FBI, the CIA, and in my case, military intelligence as well. So I applied under the act, and you know, after many delays and a lot of prodding, I got redacted copies of these files, more than 100 pages, which was quite extraordinary because I was really very low on the totem pole in the anti-war movement or at Ramparts magazine. I was in my early 20s. I was not an important person in this movement in any way whatsoever. But, you know, I felt rather flattered that they had more than 100 pages on me. Large portions of those pages were blocked out because they don't want to reveal the names of their informants. and we never figured out exactly who they were. I think they had somebody on the staff at Ramparts, but I don't know who it was, or else a clerk in the mailroom or something. But it's also a lesson when you look at this kind of stuff of just how incompetent some of these people doing the surveillance can be. For example, in the summer of 1964, my then girlfriend, now wife, and I had been among the 1,000 or so young Americans who had volunteered to be civil rights workers in the state of Mississippi. And when we got married the following year, we asked people, in lieu of giving us wedding presents, would you make a contribution to one of the civil rights organizations we'd worked for? And in the FBI agent's report, this got garbled into gave his wedding presents to Goodwill. So one should always keep aware that the surveillance that goes on is often garbled in this way. Later on, writing history, I've always found it fascinating to look at surveillance reports on people that a government considered subversive at the time. And I've looked at the Department of Justice reports on various American radicals from the First World War era and later. I've looked at British Scotland Yard reports on anti-war resistors in London, in Europe, in Britain, 1914, 1918. I actually saw some of the Soviet files on people who got arrested in the 1930s. It's a wonderful tool for historians, and it's often reveals the language that's used, the assumptions that are made often reveal as much about the watchers as about the watched.
Right, and you write about that. What really does stand out for you about the watchers?
Well, one thing you often see in all of these different situations, the ones I mentioned, and I also actually, I think the earliest intelligence report I've ever seen was one in the 1790s by a British officer who had been sent to the West Indies by London to report on slave revolts and the possibilities of future slave revolts in the various West Indian islands. One thing that comes through in all of these things is that the watchers, who are very often military or ex-military people, often assume that the people they're watching operate in a similarly hierarchical way, whereas groups of pacifists and war resistors and civil rights activists are often not hierarchical at all and are often quite disorganized. But yet when you read the reports, everything is in terms of who's giving the orders, who's the kingpin of the group, and so forth.
Well, thanks again for calling in, Nancy. Today we're speaking with Adam Hochschild, a longtime journalist and author who writes about human rights and social justice. His latest book is a collection of essays called Lessons from a Dark Time. And we have a related question about surveillance. Let's hear from KDF in Oakland. Hi, KDF.
Oh, hi. Thank you very much, Rose. Actually, it wasn't a question. It's a little story. West Coast Women's Press Plexus published news reviews, features, and so on in the San Francisco Bay Area, and we were the radical feminist newspaper of record. You know, we weren't a blog. We did first-person pyramid-form journalism and so on. And a government agency sent somebody in on us, and she's passed now. Her last name was Lewis. I'm not going to say her first name. And she also was at KPFA. And I could tell she was bad news from the beginning, but I just didn't realize how bad. And then when my partner, jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge, I told people in the collective that I was going to need help. They couldn't depend on me to make the best decisions. And she kept making it so the younger people didn't come to my assistance, which caused me to hire somebody who then embezzled all of our money, and so we wound up having to shut down. So she was really a piece of work. And then fast forward to only about a year ago, on a program economics professor was giving. He had a guest who claimed that the West Coast journalism of the radical feminists had been paid for by the government. And so I'm still trying to get her to acknowledge that that's a lot of baloney.
Wow. Well, KDF, thank you for calling, and so sorry to hear about your partner. That's awful. Let's take one more phone call. It's kind of related, and then we'll get Adam to respond. Thank you, KDF. Let's go to Lisa in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. Yes, thank you for your program. I wanted to ask about whistleblowers. I feel sometimes it's almost like we're living in parallel universes, because on the one hand, the people that are legitimate, all of us, you know, who are against Trump and against the way things are going, you know, the anti-democratic forces, and who, you know, clamor for democracy. Sometimes I've heard people, you know, talk and claim for the death penalty for Julian Assange, for example, for the role of WikiLeaks in publishing material that is detrimental to supposedly detrimental to national security, although there hasn't been any case of anyone. Or even any intelligence forces suffering as a result of anything that WikiLeaks has published. So, you know, meanwhile, there's at the, on the other end of this, on the other side of their mouth, they claim freedom of the press and all that kind of things. But nobody seems to, you know, defend the basic right of a free press and being able to publish information, because the standard, if those are the standards now, then the Pentagon Papers would never have been published to begin with. So what do you think, what do you talk, I understand you have a section in your book about whistleblowing?
I actually don't have a piece about whistleblowing particularly, although I salute whistleblowers. I think they have played an enormously important role in alerting us to government misdeeds over the years. In my America, when I'm president, Edward Snowden will get a medal. I'm less enamored of Julian Assange just because of the way he's been working so much with the Russians. But I think Snowden did something quite important in alerting us to the way that the government was not only gathering vast amounts of private communications, you know, emails, text messages, phone calls, and so on, of Americans and of allied world leaders as well. You know, they were tapping Angela Merkel's cell phone. He alerted us to that and exposed the way that the government had lied about it when asked about it. He also did it in a very responsible way, where he cooperated with major newspapers in getting this stuff out, because when you release a lot of stuff like that, you do want to vet it carefully to make sure you're not going to, you know, accidentally cause great harm to an individual or cause somebody to be killed or something. So I salute Edward Snowden. I really do.
And Adam, I wish we had more time to go through every single essay, but can you tell us this chapter, The Father of American Surveillance? Wow. I mean, it was amazing to learn about. I had never heard of this man, Major General Ralph H. Van Damme, who you call the Father of American Surveillance. This is amazing. Tell us about him.
Fascinating guy. Ralph Van Diemen was a career U.S. Army officer who went into the U.S. Army in the late 1880s. And it's funny, when you're looking at somebody, even when he's essentially an evil person, which I think this man was, it's interesting when you can see through somebody's papers and his letters and so forth, the moment when he finds his vocation. And Van Diemen found it when he was stationed in the Philippines at the very beginning of the 20th century, when the U.S. was engaged in an extremely brutal war that lasted in its most intense phase from 1899 to 1902, putting down an attempt by the Filipinos to gain their independence. When the U.S. beat Spain in the War of 1898, Spanish-American War, the Philippines, which had long been a colony of Spain and had long had an independence movement, thought, at last, now we'll have a chance to be independent. Not so. They found themselves an American colony, waged a very brutal war, which hundreds of thousands of Filipinos were killed, still struggling for that independence, which didn't come until half a century later. Van Diemen was an intelligence officer who found himself in charge of something called the Bureau of Insurgent Records in Manila, which was where they kept all the data gathered about Filipino independence advocates, actual guerrillas, people in the cities who were sympathetic, people who were suspected of being sympathetic. He reorganized this database using the most advanced information management technology of the day, which was file cards. He sent these blank file cards with many spaces to be filled in to 450 U.S. Army officers stationed around the islands and asked them to fill them out with the person's name, age, address, political sympathies, attitude towards the United States, and so forth. And you can look at all these things in the National Archives today. And eventually, the Filipino independence movement of that era collapsed because these folks, not just because of American military might, but because these folks suspected correctly that their organizations had been infiltrated. Van Diemen deployed hundreds of intelligence agents and informants. He then came back to the United States and was stationed in Washington at the time that the U.S. entered the First World War, saw the chance to begin doing his beloved surveillance again, managed to convince the Secretary of War to set up a special military intelligence branch of the Army, not for spying on the Germans, the British and French were already taking care of that in Europe, but for spying on American dissidents. He was extremely exercised about labor organizers. He felt that any move among black people to draw attention to lynchings, for example, was something inherently subversive, distracted from the war effort. He ordered a big surveillance operation against the pastor of the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, whose grandson, Martin Luther King Jr., pastor of the same church, found himself under government surveillance half a century later. Van Diemen then retired from the Army as a major general in the late 1920s, settled in California, in San Diego, and opened a private intelligence bureau, which functioned for more than 20 years, where he amassed more than 80,000 file cards on subversives of all kinds, very artfully trading information with the FBI, with local district attorneys, with prosecutors, with Army intelligence, with the heads of employers' organizations who wanted to know who was organizing their workers. And he fed information to Richard Nixon's Senate campaign in 1950, when Richard Nixon was first elected to the Senate, which he did on the basis of horrendously red-baiting his opponent, Congresswoman Helen Gahagan Douglas, with information that Van Diemen had given him.
You write that Donald Trump really built a presidency on a way of thinking very similar to Van Diemen's, from hostility to immigrants, conspiracy theories, treating wild rumors as fact.
Yeah, I think that's very true. There is a strain of this stuff that runs through American life from the middle of the 19th century onward, where the mysterious, sinister outsider is the threat. Whether that's a bearded Jew from Eastern Europe or a Mexican sneaking across the border or a Catholic coming in from Italy and being an influential agent of the Pope, you know, that kind of demonization of the immigrant, outsider, stranger, that's been with us for a long time. The picturing of what these sinister folks are doing in terms of conspiracy theories also has been with us for a long time. You know, in the early days, the villain tended to be the Pope or the Illuminati or something. It becomes all kinds of crazy things, like, you know, Pizzagate, where Hillary Clinton and John Podesta were supposedly running a child sex ring out of a pizza parlor in Washington, D.C., and somebody, a guy, so believed all this stuff that he went to the place and shot it up. So that tendency of to conspiracy thinking, to demonizing outsiders and immigrants, you know, that's been with us for a long time, and Donald Trump embodies it all.
Mm. Adam, we have about 2 minutes left. Let's end on a note, you know, talking about the people who stand to this kind of resistance and resist. And what are your thoughts about where we are right now when it comes to resisting? We did a show yesterday about climate refugees and the militarization of the border. And we followed the money, as you always have to do.
Yeah.
With so many issues, and there's a lot of money being made at the border. And with every show we do, it's like, how do you untangle this with so much money being given out, taxpayer dollars to these companies? But you do have people standing up and resisting. What are your thoughts about that aspect of this? Because people always ask, you know, what's the most effective thing we can do today based on what people did in the past?
I think the most effective thing we can do today is to register people to vote, to encourage young people to vote, to make sure that these voter suppression efforts don't succeed. That's certainly a big thing. But, you know, the opportunity to resist, the opportunity to show where you stand, it comes along in unexpected ways, and you know, we have to seize those opportunities and take advantage of it. I was very moved, for example, when right after Trump's inauguration, he tried to do the Muslim ban, and tens of thousands of people rushed to airports all over the country. You remember that? And held up signs saying, you know, you are welcome here, don't let them send you away. All right, it was a symbolic act, but it was an important one, and I think it inspired other people. The Women's March that happened a day or two after the inauguration, the largest coordinated mass demonstrations in American history. So I think that spirit of resistance is out there. I think we have to remember that resistance comes not just in the forms of mass demonstrations and civil disobedience, although certainly there's a big place for that, but also in the mundane business of organizing and registering people to vote and fighting legally against these various voter suppression efforts that are going on.
Adam Hochschild has been a journalist for more than 50 years, writing about human rights and social justice. His newest book is a collection of essays, Lessons from a Dark Time. Adam, thank you so much for all of your work. Thank you for joining us, and we would love to have you back in the new year.
Thank you, Rose. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. You can find out more about Adam's work at yourcallradio.org. Coming up tomorrow, we will have our end of the year book show, where we invite independent bookstore owners on the show to talk about what they're reading and what their customers are reading. And we would love to get recommendations from you. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow. Happy birthday to Laura Wenis, who produced today's show. Thank you, Laura. And thank you, Kevin, our studio engineer. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.